Philosophy is a vision of life. The word philosophy means love of knowledge. So a philosopher is one who pursues knowledge. Knowledge can be materialistic or knowledge can be spiritual. When we had questions about physical matters, you know, why does an apple fall on the ground, or why does the earth rotate around the sun, and so on, the physicists, the chemists, the botanists, the zoologists, the biologists, they found reason for physical problems, health problems, engineering issues. So we turn to the material scientists for solution to our physical problems. But then when I want to know who am I, how did this world originate, who created it, why was the world created, what is my goal, what is my purpose in life, we then turn to philosophers, we then turn to spiritual people who give us answers. And we turn to the scriptures, the Upanishads, the Gita, the Bible, the Quran, the Dharmapada of Buddhism, because these great thinkers approach this problem from an abstract view. See, the origin of the universe is beginningless, formless, shapeless, cannot be described, cannot be known, cannot be seen by the eyes, cannot be thought of by the mind, the intellect. So something that is so abstract cannot be seen by a telescope or cannot be described by speech. That's why it says in the Upanishad, yato vacho nivartante aprapya manasa saha. That consciousness, that Lord, that Brahman is that state where speech cannot reach, even the mind cannot reach. So to reach that state, we need abstract thinkers. Because anything that is visible is not that. Anything that I can think of, can I see? So my mind has to go from the visible to the absolute, to the subtle. And that's where we need philosophy. That's where we need scholars. And we find that even the world of science ultimately merges into philosophy. When from physics they go to metaphysics, they become philosophers. You talk to Einstein. He started out by saying, I want to know the origin of the universe. And so through quantum physics and all. But then in his later years, he says, I not only want to know the origin of the universe, but what perplexes me is what makes me ask that question. What is it that is making me? I need to find that. And once they do that, whether they are scientists, whether they are even poets or authors. If you look at Rabindranath Tagore, he was not only a great poet, but a great philosopher. His teachings were so full of wonderful messages. You look at Shakespeare. He started out as a playwright, as an author, but then his thinking, you find, is very subtle. So ultimately, they merge. The material and the spiritual world merge in the world of metaphysics. Because that is when we start thinking in more abstract terms, not in something that I can touch. Not only that, but even great social workers, even great leaders go towards, ultimately it leads them. Look at the life of Tolstoy. Look at the life of Mahatma Gandhi. He started out with trying to free the country, but then eventually he became a great thinker. Martin Luther King. He was originally a pastor, then he started fighting for freedom for blacks. And then inspired by Mahatma Gandhi's teachings, we find that even his talks and his writings lead towards metaphysics. There's a very famous statement he said. Martin Luther King said, in life, there are three movements, upward, downward, and sideward. Upward and downward, we all know, when I'm progressing, when I'm getting better, whether it's materially or physically or emotionally or intellectually, I'm going upward. And then when I'm not doing well, then I say I'm going downward, I'm not progressing. But sideward movement, when Martin Luther King talked about, what he meant was that see who is beside you, move horizontally, don't only up and down, but include everybody around you. become inclusive. When you say sideward movement, that means irrespective of color, irrespective of nationality, irrespective of financial status, we are all one. So that is called sideward movement. So these kind of beautiful ideas came from people who were political leaders, from people who were... But our Upanishads take us even one step further. The Bhagavad Gita, the Upanishads, they say movement is not only upward, downward, and sideward, but more important is inward. You have to move inward to discover the truth. As long as you look for God outside, you look for truth outside, you look for happiness outside, you look for peace outside, you will never find it. If you want true happiness, you want true peace, you want true love, you want true compassion, go inward. Find it within, and then you can bring it into your life. Anything that you want to develop outside, you have to first find it within. Because everything is within us. God is within us. And He is the source of all love, all compassion, all kindness, all justice, all truth, all sincerity. So move inward. And that is what the scriptures tell us. That's what the Upanishads tell us. That's what we do in meditation. We quieten the mind which is running into the world of objects, emotions, and thoughts. You quieten the mind and turn it inward. So the inward movement is what is required. And that is what the Bhagavad Gita teaches us. Because Sri Krishna in the 13th chapter gave us a vision of life. What life should be like. How I should live it. In the 16th chapter, he transfers that vision into action. Because we find that depending on my identification, that is how I function in the world. If I think I am this body, then all my activities for taking care of this body, you know, nourishing it, feeding it. If I think I am the mind, then emotionally I want emotional satisfaction. If I think I am the intellect, then I want to know more, I want to succeed more. But as I transfer my identification more and more inward to that spirit, then my actions become more spiritual, become more evolved. I become more inclusive instead of being exclusive and limiting myself to my friend or my people from my state or my church or my community or my family. I become more inclusive. So the 16th chapter tells us how to practice spirituality. Because philosophy without action is useless. Philosophy has to be transferred into action. Whatever I study in the Bhagavad Gita or in the Bible or wherever, I have to ultimately bring it into my life, bring it into action. So the 16th chapter is a very practical chapter that shows us how these ideas, these concepts that we have studied so far in the 15 chapters of the Bhagavad Gita, how I can bring them into my life, how I can make myself a better individual. That's why somebody told Gurudev, he said, I have gone through Bhagavad Gita 3 times. Gurudev Swami Chinmayananda says, you have gone through Bhagavad Gita, but has Bhagavad Gita gone through you? Have you imbibed those values into your life? So this 16th chapter teaches us these values. And we have studied some in the past 2 or 3 weeks. The first 3 verses talk about these values. Interestingly, these values, we look around and we find that people really don't give too much importance to it. Like somebody may come and ask you, oh, I saw you bought a new car. You have a new house. You have a new job. You know, your son is going to college. He's doing very well. But they don't come and ask you, are you more peaceful? Are you practicing honesty or sincerity? Are you less fickle? Are you less active? No, nobody asks that. In fact, if you start practicing peace and quietude and all, people say, I wonder what's wrong with him. I think he's depressed. You know, he just sits around and he's not interested in anything. He used to love to come to parties. He used to love to drink. And now he just sits home. Maybe something is wrong. Maybe he needs to go see a psychiatrist. Or maybe he needs to go see Swamiji, you know, because they think Swamiji can cure him. So we find that these values actually make us more quiet, make us more peaceful. And then you work for yourself, not to impress others, not to what the world thinks about me, but what I think about myself. How I can become a better individual, how I can. So that's the beauty of the 16th chapter, that it is teaching us these values and how we can apply them in our life. And in the first, in the second verse, in the first verse we had already done a few weeks back. If you have missed it, as you know, Tony has been putting it on the website. If you go to firstpower.info, you can listen to the old talks. But in the first verse, we had talked about fearlessness, purity of mind, constancy in knowledge, charity, control of senses, study, and so on. And then we had done part of the second verse. So we'll chant that today and continue from where we had studied last time. Ahimsa sat. त्यागः शान्तिरपैशुनम् दया भूतेष्वलो लुप्त्वम् मार्दवं ह्रीरचापलम्. So last time we had done few of the values, ahimsa being non-violence, satyam being truth, akrodha, lack of anger, tyaga, tyaga is sacrifice, renunciation, and shanti. Shanti is peace. So these we had covered last week in a lot of detail, so I won't go into that, peace of mind and so on. So we'll talk about the other values today. Apaishunam. Apaishunam is control of the tongue. Control of the tongue. Daya bhuteshu. Daya means compassion for all beings. Bhutas means all beings. Plants, animals, birds, fish, humans. Compassion for all. Aloluptvam. Aloluptvam is do not covet. Do not accumulate. Non-covetousness. Mardavam is gentleness. Peace. Softness. Hri is modesty. And achapalam, lack of excessive activity or lack of fickleness. So Krishna is saying that these values we need to inculcate before you can progress spiritually. Because people say, I want to be a more better spiritual individual. I want to be evolved spiritually. So they say, first develop these values. It does not mean that I have to wait till I develop all these, you know, 26 values, till then I shouldn't study Bhagavad Gita. No, we are not saying that. What we are saying is that as you develop these values, you will become more spiritually evolved. As you evolve spiritually, as you do more prayer, meditation, study, these values will come automatically. So it works together. They are what they call it is coexisting. They help each other. As one grows, the other one grows. So that's the purpose of practicing values. As you study, the values come automatically. As you develop the values, you find your studies and meditation getting better. So, apaishunam, control of the tongue. Because we find that the tongue is a very, very powerful weapon. We have talked even in ahimsa, because through words, you can hurt somebody so badly that the person often remembers for months or years, you know, 10 years ago you said this to me and I still don't forget. So one has to be very careful how we use our speech, because we find that the tongue, we often have no control. People sometimes they just speak without thinking. That's why we tell our children, think before you speak, before you say something angry, before you say something. And things like gossip, where, you know, you heard something about somebody which is not even true, and then you turn around and tell 10 people and spread it. So what they are doing is they are spreading all this bad information. There is a famous story about Buddha, about this woman who loved to gossip and talk bad about others. And so she said, You know, how can I fix that? You know, how can I change it? So Buddha said, do one thing. I'm giving you this packet of feathers. Now you go and put one in front of each house. So she did. She went to the whole village, spread one in front of each house. So 2-3 hours later, she came back and Buddha said, now go back and collect them all. She said, how can I collect them? The wind has blown the feathers. I don't know where they are. So she says, that is the same thing with gossip. Once you spread it, then you don't know where it will go. You don't know. So be very careful about what you speak. Then say, how about if I need to correct somebody? You know, somebody is doing something wrong. Should I not correct him? Should I not help him? Maybe my child or a friend or a co-worker or somebody, you know, at work. So they say, first of all, you know, do not comment too much about others. First, look within. You know, a lot of times what we find is wrong with others, we ourselves have that. When I have a negative quality, then when I see it in somebody else, it affects me more. So look within. But say, even if you need to correct somebody, they say, do it in private. You know, take him aside and do it with modesty, with gentleness. That look, you know, this is something I have noticed. You know, please don't do it because and it is beneficial for you. So say it in a positive way instead of criticizing or putting them down that, oh, you know, you are useless, you are worthless. But in a positive way, even children, even a 4 or 5 year old does not like to be corrected in front of his friend. You know, if your child is doing something, you tell him in front of his friend, he'll say, Dad, you shouldn't have said that in front of my friend. So even a child does not like. So that the point is that use your tongue wisely. The other point is that we often focus on people's negativities. What is wrong with this person? And so our mind is always looking at that. Person may be an excellent person, very good, have 10, 15, 20 qualities, but one negative quality, we focus on that and keep putting that person down, criticizing that person, or even if not verbally in the mind, this guy is useless, you know, he has this bad quality that. They say instead of focusing on others' negative qualities, focus on his positive qualities and praise him. Or at least in your mind say, okay, this person has all these positive, I need to learn from that. Let me become improved. So focus on other people's positive. A, what will happen is you yourself will develop positive thinking. Secondly, when you encourage or help that person or focus on his positives, the negatives will automatically reduce. Same thing for your children. If you keep criticizing them, they're not going to learn. But if you praise them and you know, give them positive reinforcement, then slowly they will automatically improve, automatically become better individual. So that's what they say. A paishanom is seeing good in others and controlling your tongue, because through tongue, you can do a lot. You can do a lot of good or you can do a lot of damage. That's why great politicians and leaders, how do they get elected? Because of their tongue, their ability to speak, their ability to inspire thousands of people when they speak on TV or speak in front of a crowd. And similarly, we find people like Hitler and all, you know, just with the power of his tongue, he was able to motivate people to commit so many negativities. So that's why apaishanam is control of the tongue, and one has to develop that. Then we talk about daya bhuteshu. So compassion for all beings. Develop tolerance. See oneness, not only in humans, but in animals, birds, and even plants. Compassion towards all beings is very necessary for a spiritual seeker. We find that sometimes, especially kids, as they are walking, they'll just pull a plant, you know, just pull the, you know, branch, or just step on an insect. You know, I mean, as a child, you may do that, but I think one has to be very conscious that am I hurting any beings by my action? At least consciously don't do that. We had talked about that a couple of weeks during Ahimsa. In fact, that Muniji who comes to Bharti's house, I keep quoting him every week because that was his main emphasis, values. And one of the very interesting thing I learned from him, he used to say that when there is grass, don't walk on the grass. If you can avoid it, even if you have to take a little detour, walk on the cement, avoid stepping on grass. Of course, if you have to go to somebody's house and they have a dinner on a lawn party, you don't have a choice. But if you have a chance, don't consciously step on the grass. Since then, I try to do that. If I have to cross it, I'll try to go around on the cement. Because the grass has life too. And he also used to say that even if you have to step on the grass, apologize mentally. I'm sorry, I'm stepping on you. So that little things like that, you know, so what it does is it develops compassion for all. Not that I have that, I'm not saying that, but just these little things, when you listen to these Mahatmas, sometimes some things stick in your mind. And or just a walking an insect, you know, just unnecessary. Of course, if you have, like we talked about, if you have ants in your house or cockroaches, you have to eliminate those. But just an insect that is crawling on the ground and not bothering you, you don't need to step on it. Just avoid it, you know. So consciously developing this love for all beings is called daya bhuteshu. And it should be compassion for all beings, not only humans, but even... That's why even, you know, in Hinduism, they promote vegetarianism, because it is the idea is that an animal is being sacrificed for your pleasure, for you to eat. And we can live with eating plants. So that is why, I'm not that I'm trying to, you know, promote or change anybody, but that is the idea behind vegetarianism, that I should not sacrifice. I mean, plants, of course, you have to eat, you know, you have to eat something. That's why, you know, Jivo jivasya jivanam, it says in the scripture, jivo jivasya jivanam. Only a living being can sustain another living being. I cannot eat rocks, I cannot eat, you know, stones. I have to eat something living. But if I eat plant, that is a lower level of life than eating an animal, because the plant, you know, hopefully feels less pain. So how do I develop that? How do I develop compassion for all beings? So they say that if you are following the path of karma yoga, if you're following the path of service, then you say that, okay, the Lord has put me here to serve the world. I'm a karma yogi. I'm an action-oriented person. So through my actions, I serve the world. And I help others as a part of my spiritual growth. I'm here to evolve. I'm here to get better. And that's the path that Mahatma Gandhi and Martin Luther King and, you know, these people chose. Through service of the world, they evolved. And seeing, that's why Mahatma Gandhi called all beings Harijans, whether they were low caste, high caste, scheduled, everybody is the child of God. So seeing the oneness of all and serving all, in the path of bhakti, in the path of devotion, if I say I am a devotee of the Lord, I love God and God, you know, I love you. Okay, if you love God, that's wonderful. Then you love all beings, just as God created me. He created everybody. So everybody is a creation of God. So just as suppose I invite you to a big function, you know, I invite you, bring you on the stage and I garland you. I gave you a garland. I honored you. You're such a great person. And then as you're leaving, I hit you on the leg with a stick. So they go, why did you hit me on the leg? He says, no, but I honored you, didn't I? I honored you, put a garland. He says, yeah, you honored me, but then you hit me on the leg. But that is what we do with God. We go to the temple or the church and we light a candle or we, you know, take a garland or, you know, light a lamp. But then we come out and beat his children. You know, when we mistreat his child, whoever that person may be, it's like you're hitting his leg. You know, on the one hand, you are garlanding God, but then you are hitting his leg or, you know, with a stick. So compassion to all, because they are all God's children. Everybody is that. So whether it's, you know, whether it's my, you know, spouse, my mother-in-law, my brother-in-law, my neighbor, anybody and everybody, compassion for all and spontaneous love for all. Again, it does not mean that I become a doormat and let people walk over me, but I should have myself not hate anybody, total compassion, total love for all beings. So in the path of karma yoga, it's service. In the path of bhakti, it's love. But how about if I'm an intellectual, I'm a jnani. I don't believe in all these emotional things, going to the temple and praying and crying and all. I'm a thinker. Okay, then if you are a thinker or you are an intellectual, then remember that if you say, I am that consciousness, I am that, then everybody is that consciousness. Just as a wave cannot say be separated from the other waves. Because why? Because I am the ocean and everybody is that ocean. So they are all me. So whether it's the path of service, path of love, or path of knowledge, they all lead to oneness. Seeing oneness in all, because that develops tolerance. So seeing the oneness, creates spontaneous love for all. Daya Bhuteshu. I can pause a couple of minutes. Any comments? Any questions? Right. No, like especially like weeds and all. You have to pull out weeds in your plant. In your home, the weeds you have to remove so that the plants may grow. But you mean pull out the trees means for what? Yeah. That's okay. So that they may grow better. Yeah, trimming trees is okay. So that they may grow better. Yeah, no, the certain botany principles you have to follow. But there should not be violence or hatred in the mind. You should not enjoy doing that. No, really, if you are doing it for the betterment of the tree, for trimming the tree so that it grows better, there's nothing wrong with that. Yeah.
I'll be mindful next time, okay?
Right. At least apologize to the tree. No, really, it should be done with compassion, you know, with kindness. It's the mental attitude is more important than the action. Throughout spirituality, again and again, Sri Krishna tells us, it is what you're thinking when you're doing. Like a surgeon cutting off a leg, you know, we had talked about that last time. He's not doing it because he enjoys chopping somebody's leg. He's doing it because the leg has cancer, and if he doesn't cut it, it's going to kill that individual. So his attitude is to save that individual, then it's okay, yes. True. Right, absolutely. Yeah, if somebody is a criminal, you know, and if he's not, cannot be reformed, they have to be, you know, taken out of society. Yes. So that's what jails are for. But again, it should be the idea eventually should not be to punish the individual, but should be to reform. Jails are actually, they come out even worse. But truly, if the prisons were truly good, you know, good, they would have training for them, vocational training. And, you know, in fact, teach them meditation, teach them spirituality. In fact, Dr. Stafford Betty, who comes to this class, who used to come, and he also is our moderator when we do a seminar every year. For several months, he was going to a prison and teaching the inmates how to meditate. And he was doing that, and he thought that in his way, he was helping them, because these are people who are so violent. And if you can teach them to become positive contributors. So prison should not be a place to punish. It should be a place to reform, to make them hopefully productive citizens, so that when they come out, you teach them carpentry or teach them, you know, electrician or some kind of trade so that they can get a job. Otherwise, they again commit another crime and go back. So that is true. Right. That's true. People who grow up without parents. My daughter was teaching in an inner city school in Oakland, for Teach for America, and she found that most of the children there were from homes where they had only one parent, you know, and then the mother had, you know, multiple children from multiple husbands or boyfriends, and the father was in jail and mother was on drugs, and so these kids have, you know, a lot of handicaps. So, but if the teacher or the, you know, the society can bring them up, actually, just today's paper or yesterday's paper, there's a very inspiring article I read. There's this 26-year-old young man who at age 4 was abandoned by his parents. His parents abandoned him, and then he grew up just going from one foster home to another. At age 8, he was raped by one of his foster parents, and then he from one home to another, and he specialized in, you know, taunting or getting the foster parents angry with him, and he knew how to trigger them. So then he would be kicked from one home to the other, and he was miserable. And finally, he ended up with one set of foster parents who knew what to do with him. When he did something wrong and he was put in jail, they said, let him stay in jail for a night. Instead of bailing him out, let him learn. And then when he came out, they then worked on developing his positive qualities and teaching him. And then now he has actually become a best-selling author. He shares his vision with other kids. He goes to schools and colleges and he talks. And he has written 2 books and he has become a great speaker and he's very well known now. And, you know, so what I'm saying is that if you get the right kind of parents or the right kind of atmosphere, even somebody with so many negative strikes against him can improve. So again, yeah, this upbringing is very important. I agree. So now we'll go to Alo Luptvam. Alolupvam is do not covet, do not accumulate. Because we find that our sense organs are meant to look outside. That's why Upanishad says, Paranchi Khani Vyatrinath Swayambhu Tasmat Paran Pashyatin Antaratmana. He says the Lord Brahmaji, the Creator, made our sense organs to look outside. And so our sense organs are always looking out, you know, seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, and never looking inwards. Tasmat Paran Pashyatin Antaratmana. And so our whole focus is on looking outside, you know, getting, acquiring, possessing, collecting. And we find that it is becomes after a while a disease, an illness, where I collect and collect and collect even more than what I need. If you go to some people's homes, oh, they are so packed, you know, crowded with, it's good when you're traveling, you buy curios and all, but anywhere they go, they buy curios and their whole house is full. There's no place to put anything more. And still they will go and get more. And you go to their garage and there are things that they have bought that they have no place to put. Just collecting, accumulating. And then they will never throw away anything, never get rid. Their closets are overpacked and they're still buying more clothes. Never getting rid. Why? It is covetousness. It is possessiveness. Oh, I may sometime need it in the future. So for that, even useless things are lying in their garage. There is no space anywhere. Their car is parked outside. Why? Because their garage is full of junk. In fact, a relative of mine, a distant cousin, I went to his house in India. And it's very interesting. He's a philosopher. He's actually a PhD. He's a PhD and his wife is also a PhD. Very intelligent. Both are professors. And you go to their house. They have an apartment. They have a flat in Bombay. In Delhi, they have a flat. And when you walk into their house, there is no place to sit. There's papers everywhere, papers and papers. And I asked him, why do you have so many papers? He says, these are all our articles and our first draft and second draft and third draft. I said, I understand the final draft you want to keep. Why are you still keeping the first and the second draft that you have modified? No, they'll never throw anything, not even papers. So their house, it looks such a mess. Why? Covetousness. They don't want to give anything up. And that's why they say that, on the other hand, if you go to somebody's house, which is very neat, or a desk, you know, some people's desk is so full of papers, and that comes from a disorganized mind, you know, never ready to give anything up. So they say if you're, once somebody told me, she says, if you haven't worn a cloth in 1 year, give it away, you'll never wear it again. If people say, what? That will eliminate half my wardrobe. That is good. Go and go to India and give it to somebody who needs it, or go to the Goodwill or whatever. So the point is that do not covet, do not accumulate. This also means I should not covet other people's property. I should not covet other. If I have, I'm reasonably successful, be happy in that. It's not that I have to take over the other guy's business and put him out of business. So develop an attitude of contentment. Does not mean that you shouldn't work hard or you should not succeed. But the idea is that I should do it for my benefit, but not to take somebody else's. I should be happy with what I have and not try to take something that doesn't belong to me. Even work, you know, at work or wherever you are, if you use or abuse others or misuse others, then you are practicing lolupthvam. So a true devotee of the Lord shares, helps others, and does not try to covet or accumulate. So that is sharing, that is being, you know, and living, you know, within our means, not just trying to, you know, grow beyond and, you know, all that. So that is alolupthvam. Mardavam, that's a very, very beautiful quality. Mardavam means gentleness, softness. And that comes from noble qualities. When you have developed all the previous qualities, when you have peace, when you have soft tongue, you have soft speech, and all these other qualities, you know, purity of mind and the right knowledge, then gentleness and softness comes automatically. Such a person, when he's dealing with others, is very kind, is very compassionate, acknowledges all. Actually, Swami Ishwaranandaji once told us a beautiful story about Eknath Ishwaran. I don't know if you have heard of Eknath Ishwaran, but he was originally born in Kerala in India and came to the US, and he was a professor at Berkeley. But he was a great thinker. He was a Sanskrit scholar, and he actually translated the Bhagavad Gita, wrote a commentary, and used to teach people how to meditate. He was a teacher of meditation and the mantra. He very much believed in the mantram, he used to call it, and he used to tell people to chant the mantra and then how to, his 8-point program, how to live. Very, very beautiful thinker. I have read some of his books. And he actually subsequently, after he retired from teaching at Berkeley, he made a farm, like an agricultural community, where a lot of his followers, most of his followers were non-Indians, were Caucasians. And so they lived on this agricultural community outside Berkeley, outside Oakland. And there they grew their own crops and, you know, lived a life of simplicity. They all used to meditate and study. His books they would read. And then, of course, they would, you know, it became his headquarters where his books and DVDs and CDs were shipped, you know, online. And also they had a, you know, online thing and all. And so he was, you know, quite very well known. So Swami Ishwaranandaji said that he once went to visit him. He was 80 plus. And actually, there was a camp we had attended in Santa Rosa, you know, just north of San Francisco. And Swami Ishwarananda at that time was a brahmachari. He was Brahmachari Someshwar. He was a brahmachari. He was not even a swami. And then there was Swami Chidananda, who was the head of the San Jose ashram. And then Guruji, Swami Tejomananda, who is the worldwide head. All three of them were conducting the camp. So Guruji was there, Swami Chidananda, and Brahmachari Someshwar. And a couple of the other leaders of the camp, they had one afternoon free. So they decided they would go visit Eknath Ishwaran, because here is this realized master who's so close, he's only a couple of hours drive. So they said, let's go visit him. So they called him, made an appointment, and these 5 or 6 people went to visit him. And so when they went, Eknath Ishwaran was sitting in a chair in a small room like that, and he got up, and he, even though he was very frail, he got up and welcomed everybody, made everybody sit down, and offered, you know, the people offered them water and all. But interestingly, he not only spoke to the head of the mission, Guruji, but he individually talked to each one who had come to visit. You know, thank you for coming to visit. What is your name? What do you do? He says, Brahmachari Swamiji says, I felt so honored, you know, that I am just an ordinary brahmachari, and look, the head of the mission is there. So he has not only spoken to him, but equally, he, in his eyes, everybody is equal. So that kind of gentleness, that kind of softness, we see in great people. That's why they say the greater a person get, the more humble, the more modest, the more, if greatness makes you more arrogant, you know, if you're arrogant about your knowledge, or if you're arrogant about your, in fact, spirituality is a very dangerous trap, because it develops a very subtle ego. That I am more spiritual than this person. I go to church more often, or I read more, or I study more, or I meditate more. So one has to be very cautious. That's why they say the plants that give the most fruit, they bend down. You know, the more fruit the plant has, the more it bends, the more humble it becomes. While, you know, that's why they say that, and Kabirji says it very beautifully. He says, do not be big like a khajur, which is so high that, like a khajur is the you know, that date tree, which is so high, it doesn't give shade to anybody, and the fruit is so high, he's so tall and arrogant that nobody can reach the fruit. So the idea is that the more you grow, the more you should become humble, because ultimately, whatever you are, there are so many people who have participated in that, your teachers, your parents, God, you know, your spiritual gurus. So whatever I have, it is because of the grace of others. So constantly remember that. And if you develop arrogance, if you develop pride, then that takes away from your... That's why they say pride goes before a fall. The moment you become arrogant, in fact, some people even develop humility as a, I am so humble. You know, that itself becomes, you know, becomes an arrogance. So the idea is that develop an attitude of gratitude, attitude of gratitude. In fact, there is one gentleman who comes to our meditation class. He has now moved to the coast, but he still comes, George Johnson. And he, interestingly, when he starts his meditation, he, for the first 5 or 7 minutes, he thinks about things to be grateful for. He says, I just start with gratitude. I don't do anything. Okay, what am I? Simple things, of course, I'm a human being. I have, and he's financially comfortable. He has a nice wife and good children, all those. He said, those things end in about 30 seconds. Then I have to think of other things that I have to be grateful for. What am I grateful for? What? He says, when I develop that 5 to 7 minutes of gratitude, the mind becomes so full of, you know, thankfulness. It becomes so humble. It becomes so gentle, so soft. He said, then my meditation goes better. So it's very interesting, you know, thinking back on what do I have to be grateful for. In fact, another technique that I practice, I find it helps me a lot, is that suppose there is something going wrong in my life. Okay, there is one problem, whatever it may be, you know, at work or in the family or home or children. Okay, one thing is wrong. Okay, so what we do is we keep focusing on that wrong. Oh, why is God punishing me? Why is God making me so miserable? So it's okay, you make a line. I make a imaginary line, or you can do it on a piece of paper. Okay, one side, okay, this problem. And the other side, then I try to focus on all that is going good in my life. I have my health, I have, you know, financially I'm comfortable, I am this, I am my profession, I have this. So when you add, and I have, you know, good family and children, when you add all those things that are going well, and then suddenly that one thing becomes small, it's not that big. So focusing on the positive makes you more grateful, makes you more grateful. And then not that you don't take care of that problem, but then that problem becomes less of a problem. So develop this habit of making a mental line, and you will find it helps you so much. Just draw a line and say, okay, this problem is there. Okay, but what about all those other things that are going well in my life? Then automatically you'll become more cheerful, you'll become more happy, and you'll become more soft, more peaceful. Then the next is re or modesty. Modesty is not showing off. Do not disturb others. Do not brag. Do not. What some people do is they just want to show off. They come into a party or a group and they just start speaking loudly, or they talk about what they have, new thing they have bought, or how they are successful, how busy they are, how great they are. And what that does is, it first of all, it irritates others, but also gives you a false sense of pride, you know, of arrogance, and then it hurts others. It makes you more arrogant, and then you become less grateful. You become less grateful to God because you think, I did it, I and my. There's actually a children's story. It's in the library, but it's a funny story. It's worth reading. But I always tell my grandchildren this story. So I don't know if you guys will enjoy it, but it's fun to hear. Anyway, there is this story about Kubera. You know, Kubera is the treasurer of the gods. So in heaven, there is this treasurer who is the repository of all the wealth of heaven, and he controls it. So he's the treasurer. And so as people need, you know, money, he distributes. So he's, of course, himself very rich, and his house is all made of gold, and everything is gold, and so beautiful. And it says that one time he became very arrogant because he had all this money and wealth and all. And he said, I am the richest person in heaven, not only in earth, but heaven, everywhere. And so he slowly became more arrogant. And it says that, it is said in that children's book that he had a party. He says, Kubera threw a party. And he invited all the gods in heaven, Vishnu and Brahmaji, and, you know, the god of wind and god of Varuna and god of the oceans. They were all invited. It was going to be a grand party, you know, like a party that nobody has ever seen before. And so great. So all of them were invited. So then he goes to invite Lord Shiva. You know, Lord Shiva, he goes to Mount Kailash and says, I want you to come to my party. Shiva says, look, I don't go to parties. Shiva, you know that. He's just wearing a, you know, a tiger skin and sitting in the mountains in the snow and meditating. He says, I have no interest in your parties. I'm not coming. He said, no, Shiva, you have to come. You know, I am this grand party. Everybody's going to be there. Even Vishnu Bhagavan is going to be there. Brahmaji is going. He said, look, I'm not going. If you want, you can take my son, Ganesh. Ganesh, you can take him. He'll go. So Ganesh was a young boy, you know. He says, okay, I'll take him. He says, but Shiva says, look, but he looks small, but he has a big belly. He has a huge appetite. He loves to eat. Kubera, what do you mean loves to eat? I have so much money. I have so much food. I have warehouses stocked with food. Don't worry about it. I'll feed him well. So in his private jet, they show this picture of Ganesha going in his private jet saying bye to his father, and in his jet he's going to the party. And so Kubera, of course, is very arrogant, riding with him. And so he sits down and he starts eating. And in this particular occasion, I guess Ganesh decided to teach him a lesson. So he started eating and eating and eating and eating, and he kept on eating, and food kept on coming, and the servants were running. You know, one group was running to bring the food, other one was clearing the plates. And he ate so much that all the food was finished. There was no food in his kitchen. Whatever he had cooked, everything was finished. And still he was hungry. I want more. I want more. Now Kubera is worried. You know, where am I going to bring food from? And then he was so hungry, he started eating the plates. The golden plates and everything he started eating. He said, I'm going to eat. So Kubera got very worried. You know, he's going to eat my whole house. What am I to do? I cannot satisfy him. So he runs to Lord Shiva. He flies in his charter jet back. He said, Lord Shiva, please save me. He said, what happened? He said, your son is going to eat me out of my house. He's eating even the plates and the tables and chairs. He's eating everything. He said, okay. I told you he has a big appetite. He says, yeah, but I didn't know such a big appetite. So then Shiva gives him two grains of puffed rice. You know, the churmura, the kurmura they call. Two grains of puffed rice blessed. And he said, go give them to him with love. And so he flies and he gives them to Ganesha. He puts them in his mouth. Ah, he's so happy because his father had sent these two grains of rice with love. So the point is, the moral of the story is that one should not brag about one's possessions. Showing off, you know, where you disturb others is not a good quality, not a quality of a seeker. So develop modesty, be thankful, and do not disturb others. My actions, wherever I go, my actions should bring peace. And that can only come when you have peace within. If your mind is disturbed, then obviously you will create disturbances around you. So develop these positive qualities, and through developing peacefulness, you will develop modesty. Next value is achapalam. This is a very, very nice value, achapalam. Chapalam means excessive activity. Achapalam means lack of excessive activity. And we find that some people just working, just with, you know, constantly without stop. Or even if they're not working, they're sitting, but their hands are moving, their legs are moving, they're walking around, they can't even sit still for a moment. And constantly just moving around, and you tell them, sit still. You know, in youngsters, it's okay. You know, if you're a 2 or 3 year old boy or a 5, you know, they are by nature very hyper and active, and that's okay. But as when I grow up, I should develop the ability to sit still and do nothing. So one has to practice that. And where does it come from? It comes from mental. When my mind is overactive, when my mind is overworking, then my body also. So the mind and the body are connected. If my mind is very disturbed, if my mind is very active, if my mind is agitated, then it reflects in my physical actions. If my mind is quiet and peaceful, then automatically my physical activity gets less. And that's why they say practice doing nothing. You know, we in this modern age, we're unable to do that. Because if nothing else, I'll turn on my cell phone and just check the news or check the internet or check my emails. So they say, just turn the phone off and sit for half an hour and do nothing. Just sit in the backyard and watch the trees. Nothing wrong with that. You know, so develop this achapalam, develop this lack of activity. And one of the problems with the modern society, partly, of course, is having the cell phone and having the computers where you have constant access to information that is fed to you 24 hours a day, you know. The same news again and again and again. Now this plane crashed. Now for days they're going to talk about that pilot. And I mean, it is important news, but the point is that the news is constantly fed to us. And so our mind is constantly disturbed. When the mind is agitated, So when the mind is constantly disturbed, when the mind is constantly agitated, it leads to excess physical activity. So part of the reason for that is stimulants, too much caffeine. because caffeine or other stimulants that we use are stimulate the mind. In fact, I myself had this problem a few years back. About 20 years ago, my practice was so busy. I used to work from morning till night, even on the weekends, go in at night. And so how did I work with caffeine? I used to have tea, coffee, Pepsi, Coke all day. And then I was trying to learn how to meditate. And then I asked Swami Ishwarananda ji, my mind runs during meditation. So he tells me, he said, every time I see you, you're with caffeine. How do you expect your mind to be quiet? He asked me to give it up. The way he found out was, he used to come from LA and I had to drive about an hour and a half to pick him up. And I had to usually pick him up at about 7 in the morning, because the person who used to drive him would drop him like halfway, past Magic Mountain. So he would bring him at 7 and I had to pick him up. So that means I have to leave my house at 5:30. And so by the time I'm driving back, I'm already sleepy because I've woken up early and had to have a shower and all before I go. So I used to carry a can of Pepsi or something with me. So he used to tell me, look, you're having caffeine all the time. How do you expect your mind to be quiet? And he was right. And so it helped me once I went to this camp in Piercy in Northern California. And for a week, I was there in that very peaceful atmosphere, meditating in the morning. And there I decided to give up caffeine. And I actually did. I completely gave up tea, coffee, Pepsi, Coke, everything. And it took me about 2 or 3 days of headache, but I finally got over it. Not that 1 or 2 cups of tea is okay, but I think taking too much of stimulants, where you need the stimulants to work. People get this 5-hour energy drink. That means for 5 hours, you cannot control that person. He's so hyper, he's so full. And this energy doesn't end in 5 hours. It goes on and on. I think she's there. So this overactivity, one has to control. I remember, using these drugs reminds me of a story. Actually, this is a true story. When I was in medical school, I think it was the finals, the fifth year finals. And so, it's not like the semester system or quarter system. It's like 1.5 year you study, and then the last 3 months you are mugging and you are studying hard to remember everything you have studied in the past year and a half. So it's a lot, very intense, and you have to do well because depending on your grades, that's the kind of residency you will get, the kind of field. So it's very, very competitive. And so people study late at night and have caffeine and all. I remember we used to have caffeine or coffee at 8, 9 o'clock and study till 2. But one of these guys in our hostel, he took it to an extreme. What he used to do was around 8, 9 at night, he will take this amphetamine, this speed. And so he will take that. And so from 8 or 9 till 2 in the morning, he'll study with speed. And now 2 o'clock, he wants to sleep and he can't sleep because he's so stimulated, so then he will take Valium to sleep. So for 3 months, you're a pharmacist, you know how bad it is. So he will take speed from 8 to 2 and then Valium from 2 to 8 to speed to sleep. And that's how he functioned for 3 months. And interestingly, even the night before the exam, before his finals, he did the same thing. He took speed at night to study and then woke at 2 o'clock to sleep. He took Valium. And then 8 o'clock, he went to the test. And he couldn't remember a thing. All his year and a half of studies, he could not remember even a single word. He could not answer a single question on that question paper. And he flunked and he failed. So the point is that these mind-altering drugs, whether they are antidepressants or sedatives, they have a lot of bad effects on us. So one has to be very cautious what you put in your mind, because this leads to excessive. First, you become depressed, then you take antidepressant, then you become overactive, and then you take something else. And that's why, psychiatrists, they use multiple drug combinations, one to elevate you, one to depress you, and it just plays with your mind. So be very cautious what you put in your mind, because excess activity is one of the values that one should develop, that I should develop. A lack of excess activity, the ability to sit calm, to be quiet, and I should become a source of peace and quietude in my surroundings, not become a source of disturbance. That's why when you're in the presence of Mahatmas or these great, you know, teachers or Swamijis, when you sit with them, you feel so much at peace. Or when you drive with them in your car, if you have an opportunity to drop them, take advantage of that. Because it is such a great experience. Even if they may not talk to you, even if they sleep, just being in their presence is very nice. And that's why when all these Swamijis come, take advantage of that opportunity. Sit and listen to their talks. Maybe offer them lunch or dinner and just be in their presence. It is so uplifting. Because we find that these values that are described in the Bhagavad Gita are actually being practiced by individuals. So when, at least whatever little I have learned, it is, you know, because of my contact with Swami, of course, Chinmayananda with his teachings, and then Guruji, Swami Tejomayananda, who is the head of the mission, and Swami Ishwarananda and Vimalji, and all these wonderful teachers that have come here and that I have had the pleasure to meet with. And so I have been blessed. So take advantage of that. And that is how you can develop these qualities by interacting with these. Any comments on any of these values?
I guess there is an ideological conflict that we all
right.
have. So if you have the conflict, it's kind of hard to put the rest of the values in practice.
Yeah, I think that's why they have listed 26. Because you may not have all 26 fully developed. You know, a saint or a Mahatma or a realized master may have, but for you and me, the ways we had talked about it before, that each day you practice one value. If you have 26 days, 26 values, okay, today I'm going to practice modesty, today I'm going to practice peace, shanti, today I'm going to practice honesty, I'm going to practice ahimsa. So to that extent that I can, you know, even though maybe you're exploiting nature, but then in your spare time, maybe plant trees or do something, you know, to make up for that. Or, you know, again, one has to earn a living and you may not be able to practice all 26 uniformly, but to the extent you're able to practice, and that's what they say, do one a day. And then at the end of 26 days, it's almost a month, then you start again. So once you become conscious that I have this value, then maybe I may want to modify my practice in my business, or maybe develop a side business where I'm doing something to promote nature, or at least I become aware of that. See, that is the whole idea of studying the Bhagavad Gita, is that I become aware that I have these, like, you know, like excessive restlessness of my mind. I had that. And so I asked Swamiji and he gave me the solution. Also, by reducing the work, because I used to work too much and now have made a conscious effort. I don't go to the hospital. I do mostly outpatient. So because then I don't have time otherwise, you know, to prepare for these classes. And also, as you become aware by contact with these people, then you can start bringing them into your life. Not that I have, you know, developed all of them. I'm not saying that. But at least you start becoming aware, then you will make an effort. So that is the idea of studying these values. And even if out of 26, even if you have 15 or 20, you are practicing, that's good. It's better than, you know, none. So that's why I read this, and especially Swami Chinmayananda's commentary. Everybody should buy this. It's available in the office. It's only $25 or $27. And all the 18 volumes, it's $1.50 for one chapter of Bhagavad Gita. $1.50, man, you can't even buy a cup of coffee these days. You get a whole chapter of the Bhagavad Gita. So 18 chapters, you know, 18 volumes. So everybody should read it, because Swamiji's commentary is so beautiful. Actually, I was meaning to read one paragraph when he talks about speech. I mean, his English is unbelievable. I'll read it out to you. He's talking about speech, what kind of speech we should have. He said, a speech, what should be the speech? With softness of tone, clarity of expression, honesty of conviction, power of bringing a clear picture in the listener's mind with no veiled meaning, overflowing with sincerity, devotion, and love, becomes the autobiography of the speaker's personality. So when you speak, these are the qualities you should have. Softness of tone, clear expression, express clearly what you're saying, honesty of conviction, you should be telling what you believe in, and the power of bringing a clear picture. So when you're, the listener should know exactly what you mean, do not have any hidden meanings. Then your speech should have sincerity, devotion, love. So before speaking, these six things you should have, then you should speak. So that's what I'm saying. His commentary is masterful. His command over English was unbelievable. I've heard him talk personally also many times. Great speaker he was, great orator. So you know, being aware of that and contact with these Mahatmas does help. Yeah.
I think it's some challenging too, because our society is so based on...
Yeah, but to the extent I can practice... See, the teaching is, Bhagavad Gita is not for others, it's for me. So to the extent I can practice these values, at least I make my surroundings better. I plant more trees, I help society. And what this, let the world, you know, you tell them it's your world, you take care of it. I cannot be responsible for what's happening in Africa and Middle East and all. I can only be responsible for what is happening in Bakersfield, in my little corner. Om Sarve Bhavantu Sukhinaha, Sarve Santu Niramayaha, Sarve Bhadrani Pashyantu, Ma Kashchit Dukha Bhag Bhavet. Om Shanti 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 Harihi Om Shri Gurubhyo Namah Harihi Om.